morning, Ms. Dean. How are you?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to address first our argument in this case that had to do with the penalty hearing. We made a request prior to the penalty hearing asking the court to provide for a bifurcated penalty hearing in this case. And we asked that the jury first be presented with evidence in the narrowing phase on the issue of whether or not the crime was committed for financial gain. And if they found that it was beyond a reasonable doubt, that then and only then they proceed to the weighing phase. And the reason for our request was that we knew that in the penalty hearing there was going to be a lot of 404 bad acts, a lot of negative evidence that was going to come out about our client. And we felt that the jury should not be influenced by hearing that bad acts and bad character evidence during their narrowing phase on the narrow issue of financial gain. And in the court's decision in the Bryce case, answering the certified questions about the new death penalty statute, there is some language, this court, in answering certified question number 2 in Bryce on page 322, the court says the non-statutory aggravators, if considered at all, do not enter the mix until after the jury performs its essential function during the narrowing phase. So in that language in Bryce, this court has recognized that there should be a separate determination. The jury could not possibly have ignored all the bad character evidence that came out in the penalty hearing. And even if they had been instructed, which they were not, to determine it, the facts individually and separately, it would have been virtually impossible for them to have done that. There was a lot of very negative body language and a lot of very negative attitude, we felt, from the jury directed to our client. In fact, two of the jurors even attended the sentencing, which seemed to us a little unusual. The other case, way back in 1972, when this court considered Karpinski versus State, a family court case where the court had to determine certain facts which would or would not enhance the sentencing in Karpinski. And in that case, back in 1972, Justice Herman found that the rules of evidence should apply during that portion of the trial because those factors had to be found beyond a reasonable doubt. And that same rationale, we believe, should apply to this case.
Ms. Dean, you're contending for a bifurcated penalty hearing, correct?
Yes.
And what would be the order of the bifurcated hearings? What issue would be heard first and determined first?
Well, the jury should first determine whether or not they find beyond a reasonable doubt any of the statutory aggravating factors, what we refer to as the narrowing phase. In this case, was the crime committed for financial gain? So if the jury, it wouldn't be every case that this would apply to, depending on the facts, but if requested, there should be a separate hearing on the statutory aggravating factors. If at least one of the statutory aggravators is found, then they would go, only then would they go into a separate hearing, which would be separate, but could be the same day or depending on the time frame.
And in the second hearing, the jury would determine whether there are mitigating factors and what the relative weight should be?
Yes, Your Honor.
Don't you run into the same problem with that sequence that you claim to have with the current unitary hearing? That is, after the jury heard all of the evidence relating to whether or not the homicide was for pecuniary gain, that bad evidence could color their viewpoint, arguably, on the mitigating factors.
It could, Your Honor. It certainly could. But at least while they're determining the statutory aggravator, they're not hearing all of the bad acts evidence and other bad things about the defendant, and they're allowed to focus only on the aggravating factor.
Ms. Dean, let me get something clear in my mind. You keep using the phrase, we should do it this way. First, the statute doesn't outline that we must do it that way. And as I understand the ruling of the trial judge, he concluded that Ring and its progeny, Apprendi or otherwise, whichever came first, doesn't constitutionally mandate that it be handled that way. Is your argument that despite his ruling, in fact, Ring and Apprendi do mandate that there be a bifurcated hearing, and if so, for what reason?
The cases do not specifically address that point and do not specifically mandate a bifurcated hearing.
Well, is this then abuse of discretion, or is this constitutionally mandated and the trial judge erred as a matter of law?
Well, we believe there was an abuse of discretion in denying our motion for a bifurcated hearing. But at the same time, we do believe the defendant, if they request it, is constitutionally deserves a bifurcated hearing to prevent all of the inadmissible evidence which would be otherwise
right.
Inadmissible.
You lose me again when you say constitutionally deserves. What does that mean? Simple me, it's either constitutionally mandated or it is not, and then it becomes a question of abuse of discretion. Tell me where we are.
We believe it's a violation of the defendant's right to due process to allow 404 evidence in the penalty hearing before the statutory aggravator has been decided.
Okay. Tell me the source of that authority. Why should we rule that way?
Well, it's a matter of fundamental fairness, and in many cases it's been found that where there is an element of the crime that has to be decided, which affects, of course, the penalty naturally, that the defendant is entitled to have objectionable, inadmissible evidence excluded. And so when he is in a penalty hearing arguing for his life, that evidence should be excluded in that phase, which presents bad character and bad act evidence. This is not a point that has been decided, I don't believe, by this court, and I don't think it's specifically addressed in either Ring or Apprendi either. And the language that I cited in Bryce indicates the concept of it being not part of the mix, but it certainly has not been specifically decided. And it is our position that this inadmissible evidence impermissibly taints the penalty hearing when it's brought in before the jury has decided the aggravators.
Are cases where arguably the aggravator is found in the trial phase, does that complicate your mix?
No, it's our position that this bifurcated hearing would not be required in every case. It all depends on the facts of the case. And certainly there are some cases where, for example, if it's a felony murder, where it would not be called upon. But if requested, it's our position that it should be granted.
Well, if what we're talking about here is a constitutional entitlement, then wouldn't we have to spell out in an opinion in very clear terms when that entitlement arises and when it doesn't. That is, if a bifurcated penalty hearing isn't required in every case, when would it be required?
Well, I think that the court would have to take it. The court should take it on a case-by-case basis, depending on the facts of each individual case. In some cases, the statutory factor has already been proven during the trial itself, but in other cases, it has not. So I think this is, we're arguing a narrow issue here, that in this particular case, there was great prejudice to our client by allowing in all this bad character evidence. Now, as far as a broader application, the court would need to decide how to address that, but it should probably be on a case-by-case basis. But in this particular case, there was tremendous prejudice to Mr. Plouffe because of the evidence that came in. There were numerous acts that he stole a tractor, that he had assaulted a girlfriend, that he had an affair with a co-worker's wife, and other various things, which really, we believe, inflamed a jury.
Did the trial judge expand at all on the rationale for his reason for denying your motion? I ask that question because all I caught from the transcript that was provided was that neither Ring nor Apprendi constitutionally mandated it, nor did the statute revised after Ring in Delaware address the issue, and that was it. That's all he said.
That is all he said. What is in the transcript is all I recall him saying.
But you made the fundamental due process violation argument to him?
Yes, we did. It was presented in a written motion for a bifurcated penalty hearing, and that, to the best of my recollection, what is in the transcript is all he said, that it was not required by the statute, it was not required by the cases, and our request was denied.
Okay. Can you?
You've already acknowledged, I think, that this rule you're advocating would not apply universally in death penalty cases, but only on a case-by-case basis, depending upon the facts. So let's focus for a second on the facts here. Didn't the jury essentially find that it was for pecuniary a murder committed for pecuniary gain in finding him guilty? You know, given the nature of what the state presented as the evidence and what the defense was on the guilt phase?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. There was also evidence that he was having an affair at the time. He had a girlfriend. They could have just as well believed that he did it because he wanted to be with his girlfriend. There were other possible motives that were put forth besides pecuniary gain in the body of the trial itself, primarily the affair that he was having at the time. So we don't believe that the jury absolutely necessarily decided that in the trial itself.
Ms. Dean, I've been looking at the list of statutory aggravating circumstances. Give us an example of how this would work. Because, for example, one of the statutory aggravating circumstances would be that the person had escaped and committed the murder, you know, when they were escaped from confinement. You seem to be suggesting in this case that evidence of these bad acts would lead the jury to conclude the crime was committed for pecuniary gain. Now, why wouldn't that operate in any circumstance? If the jury's going to be influenced in finding a statutory aggravator, even though it's not supported by the evidence because they're influenced by all of these bad acts, that's going to be a problem every single time. But historically, we've always let the jury decide whether there's a statutory aggravator, and then go to the weighing. I think the only difference we have now under the amended statute is the jury will probably be instructed, if they're not unanimous on the statutory aggravator, they go no further. Is that right?
Yes.
So tell me why they were more likely than not to find that this was committed for pecuniary gain because they heard this other evidence.
Well, because we're not privy to the jury deliberations, we really, of course, don't know what they talked about and what they were thinking. But in our view, it is impossible for the jury to put out of their minds all of the bad character evidence that they have heard during the penalty phase, and just to erase that from their minds and to concentrate only on the narrow issue is, was it committed for pecuniary gain? They have to just forget everything else while they decide that, and we believe that that is very, very unlikely, if not impossible.
You wanted to reserve 10 minutes. You're into your rebuttal time. Did you want to bring up any other issues now, or do you want to save your remaining time?
Well, the only other thing briefly I'd like to bring up, Your Honor, is the third argument, which has to do with a comment that was made during the trial about the defendant being represented by a public defender. At that time, it was just an instruction to disregard the testimony. But later, after the guilt phase, a juror indicated to the court, the court learned that this juror had had a discussion about the case with a co-worker, and in that discussion, there was a reference to Mr. Plouffe being represented by a public defender. And at that point, we asked for a mistrial, which we believe should have been granted. It was denied, and this case has some analogy to a Superior Court case called State versus William Johnson. It's unpublished. It's a part of the brief where a Kent County case where there was defendant, both the prosecutor and a prosecution witness mentioned that the defendant was represented by the public defender, and Judge Steele ruled that that was prejudicial because the defendant had had two jobs, and the jury might think that anybody who had two jobs shouldn't have a public defender. And that is right on point with this case because Mr. Plouffe also worked at two jobs, and we believe it was very prejudicial for the jury to hear that he was represented by the public defender.
Good morning, Mr. Williams.
Good morning, Justice Howell and members of the court. May it please the court. I'll attempt to address the third and fourth issues that were raised today, but if the court has questions about any of the other arguments, certainly I'll attempt to respond to those as well. Turning briefly to the third argument, which I think is maybe the simpler of the two, that's the question having to do with the public defender reference. What happened here was that during the defense case, there was a defense witness by the name of Carl Chance, and the prosecutor was cross-examining Mr. Chance, and the question was asked of Mr. Chance if he had discussed his trial testimony before trial at the public defender's office and had given a statement to the public defender investigator. Mr. Chance replied that no, he had not. The first time he had seen anyone from the public defender's office was the preceding Monday. There were two statements or two references to the public defender. After that, the trial judge excused the jury and indicated that he was going to give a curative instruction to the jury. The state agreed with that, and that was the only relief that was requested on behalf of Mr. Plouffe at that time. When the jury returned to the courtroom, they were given a prompt curative instruction here. Normally, such a curative instruction, which tells the jury to disregard any reference to the public defender is deemed to be sufficient. We assume that the jury does, in fact, follow the court's instructions. Here, the only difference was that approximately 6 days later, after Mr. Plouffe had been found guilty, there was another issue that arose concerning juror number four, who was a lady by the name of Pat Vincent. A co-worker had contacted the Superior Court jury commissioner, and it indicated that there had been some discussion about the trial after the trial had, the guilt phase of the trial had concluded, involving Pat Vincent. Pat Vincent was interviewed by the trial judge, and she indicated that some co-workers had asked her about the trial, and one of the questions that was asked by a co-worker of the juror was whether or not Mr. Plouffe had been represented by a public defender. Pat Vincent's response was that she didn't know. Apparently she didn't recall this reference 6 days earlier at trial about the public defender, and her response was, "I don't know, he had a lawyer," and that's all she said. Now, Pat Vincent actually did not serve during the penalty phase of the hearing. She was excused after that, although it doesn't appear that she had done anything wrong, and Mr. Plouffe had already been found guilty of the first-degree murder allegation at that point in time. In this particular case, this was an inadvertent prosecutorial reference. Certainly it was improper and should not have occurred. However, in determining whether or not a new trial should have been granted, and the mistrial was the application that was made after the disclosure with Pat Vincent, the court has to determine if substantial rights of the accused have been prejudicially affected. And what this court normally does is apply the three-part test that was utilized in Hughes, and that's what the couple of trial court decisions that the two sides have cited here have done here. You look at the closeness of the case, and the state submits that this was not a close case, that there was substantial evidence of Mr. Plouffe's guilt here, that his own account or story simply was implausible here and was rejected by the jury. The second factor is the centrality of the issue, and I think that's perhaps the most problematic factor here, because I think pecuniary gain was the statutory aggravator that was found. However, there was substantial evidence, and I think this goes to the fourth argument that I'll attempt to address in a minute. There was substantial evidence presented during the guilt phase of the pecuniary gain, the $100,000 life insurance policy here. And the final Hughes factor is, what do you do? You look at the steps that are taken to mitigate the error. Here, the judge gave a prompt curative instruction, which is the normal relief that a defendant's entitled to, and as I said, the jury is assumed to follow the trial court's instructions. So under all of these factors, I think the trial court handled the matter properly, that this was not a close case. There was a prompt curative instruction, and while it did affect a central issue, it was certainly cumulative to other evidence that the jury had already heard. They had heard testimony from at least three witnesses regarding the financial straits of Mr. Plouffe. One of the witnesses had testified that his bank account was very meager, and she assessed that as him, in fact, being broke. Two other witnesses had testified that Mr. Plouffe had told them prior to the homicide that soon his financial problems would be over, apparently an inadvertent reference to receiving this, a tangential reference to anticipation of receiving the insurance policies here. There was testimony from a Sherry Hobbs, who was the manager at the Biddle's Towing Service, and another fellow named Dave Eckert. So the jury had already heard all of this and were well aware of the financial straits facing Mr. Plouffe prior to when the body was discovered on, I believe it was November 4th of 2001. The fourth issue is a somewhat novel claim here, and I think the trial judge handled it appropriately. There is no requirement under the Delaware statute for a trifurcated proceeding, that is a proceeding in a capital prosecution where you first have a guilt phase and then you have a penalty phase, but you further subdivide the penalty phase into two separate sections, the first section being the jury separately deciding the existence or non-existence of the statutory aggravators that are alleged, and then and only then if they find a statutory aggravator unanimously does the jury then hear evidence about mitigation as well as aggravation in the non-statutory categories here. The only authority that was cited was the Vermont District Court decision in United States versus Fell. However, that was subsequently overruled by the Second Circuit here. There is no constitutional requirement, at least as interpreted by Apprendi and Ring, that there be a bifurcation of the penalty hearing. The Delaware statute does not require it, and simple due process, I think, does not require it here. What Plouffe is attempting to do is speculate as to what influenced the jury's decision. But I think if you look at what the jury's decision was, there was a 12-0 finding that the statutory aggravator of pecuniary gain was found. The second statutory aggravator that the state had alleged, substantial pre-planning, the jury vote on that was 11-1. Now, you would assume that if this jury had been so impermissibly tainted and so overwhelmed by the other bad character evidence that the state had introduced as non-statutory aggravators, that a reasonable result would have been that the jury would have found both statutory aggravators unanimously. The jury did not do that, and I think that is indicative of the fact that they were exercising their independent judgment. There's no reason to assume that this jury could not separate or segment the different tasks that the jury was being assigned here. The argument, as I say, is speculative in that the court is being asked to speculate that somehow this other bad character evidence, the theft of the tractor, the fact that Mr. Plouffe was found in possession of a shank while in prison, that impermissibly tainted the factual finding the jury made on the one statutory aggravator that they did determine, pecuniary gain. And again, the pecuniary gain evidence was substantial at the guilt phase because it was relevant for purposes of showing motive. I think there was only one witness who testified in any detail at the penalty hearing on behalf of the state concerning the pecuniary gain factor. The state simply relied, as it can under Gregg and I think Flamer, on the evidence that was presented at the guilt phase regarding that statutory aggravating circumstance. And there was substantial evidence at trial. I've already alluded to three of the witnesses who testified, and I think there was actually a fourth witness, a lady who was present at Mr. Plouffe's residence after the homicide, a day or so after the homicide, when Mr. Plouffe was on the phone trying to find out how soon he could collect on the $100,000 insurance policy. The insurance policy was a policy that had gone into effect for spouses of active military. It had gone into effect November 1. This homicide occurred sometime around November the 3rd in the evening. The car was seen driving into the Walmart parking lot about 9:18 on the evening of November 3rd, so the homicide probably occurred shortly after that. In this particular instance, I don't see any compelling reason to further attempt to bifurcate penalty hearings, and some of the problems have already been alluded to in the questions that have been asked. It's certainly only going to be applicable in cases where a statutory aggravator is not established during the trial itself. Many of our trials, the statutory aggravators are already established during the trial. There are felony murder. One of the enumerated felonies is one of the statutory aggravators under our statute. So I think here you're not setting the jury up for any impossible task. The jury is frequently required to make decisions, segregate or separate evidence, and they do that when they return separate verdicts on various charges that may be facing an individual. They are told to look at the evidence as to this charge separately, look at the evidence as to a second charge separately, and return separate and distinct verdicts. And that's all the jury is doing in the penalty phase here. The suggestion is simply speculation. There's no evidence of it. The evidence that we do have is that the jury kind of reached a split decision on the two statutory aggravators that were alleged. They found one, but they didn't find the other. If there was an impermissible taint that so engulfed the jury, a more reasonable result would have been that the jury would have unanimously found both statutory aggravators. If there's any additional questions, I'll attempt to answer those, or if the court wishes me to address any of the other three arguments, I'll try to answer those questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Well, we respectfully disagree with the state that the evidence was overwhelming of Mr. Plouffe's dire financial straits. There was evidence that he was working at two jobs. For example, as Mr. Williams said, there was evidence that he had about $1,000 in the bank. His girlfriend characterized that she thought that meant he was broke. A lot of people have $1,000 in the bank. They don't think they're broke. So we do not believe the evidence that he was in dire financial straits was overwhelming. There was evidence to the contrary, that he was paying his bills on time, he had some money in the bank, he had income from two jobs. So the issue of pecuniary gain was not open and shut. When the penalty phase came, the jury still had some decisions to make, and they had evidence both ways that they had to weigh. Now, the Fell decision addressed the Fell case addressed a much broader issue of rather on the constitutionality of the federal death penalty statute. We're talking about a much narrower issue here, and that is Mr. Plouffe's due process rights in this particular case. Now, if 404B evidence is not admissible at trial on guilt or innocence, it should not be admissible during the narrowing phase of the penalty hearing when the defendant's life is still in the balance. We don't know why the jury found 12-0 on one aggravating factor and 11-1 on the other. We have no way of knowing what they were thinking about. But we also don't know what they would have done if they had not heard all of the bad character evidence at the same time they were trying to focus on financial gain. The factor of the reference to the public defender, of course, ties in to the same issue, because at some point during the trial they had heard that he was represented by a public defender, and we believe that that certainly may have been a factor that they considered if they believed he was in dire financial straits in spite of working at two jobs. When the issue first came up, it was not as clear. But when it came up for the second time through the conversation of this juror with a friend, it became a much greater concern. And we do not know, of course, what input this juror or other jurors had during the guilt phase, and we have no way of knowing exactly what their deliberations were. I don't know if the court has any other questions.
Thank you. And the court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.